Red Eye is 3 hours of alternative politics and culture, broadcast live from 9 until noon every Saturday morning on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver, Canada. Here's Mordecai Breenberg.
Those who commit war crimes invariably seek to escape accountability. They destroy or hide records of their crimes. They block independent investigation. They seek in every way to discredit the accounts of the victims. Conversely, to give voice to the victims and to detail how the crimes were committed are essential parts of the universal struggle for justice. Ramzi Baroud accepted the difficult responsibility of giving voice to Palestinian victims of the Israeli military assaults in April 2002 on the refugee camp of Jenin in the occupied West Bank. The book he has published, Searching Jenin, Eyewitness Accounts of the Israeli Invasion, possesses a remarkable immediacy and conveys the dignity that people were able to sustain even in the midst of the barbaric cruelties to which they were subjected. Ramzi Baroud was born and raised in a refugee camp in the Gaza Strip, and he joins me now on the phone from Seattle area, where he now lives and works. Good morning, Ramzi, and welcome to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio.
Good morning, Mordecai, and thank you so much for having me.
Could you describe for people, probably most of us are not familiar with the physical dimensions and the population of the Jenin refugee camp before the Israeli assault almost exactly 1 year ago?
The Jenin refugee camp, as some of us may already know, was established in 1953. To meet the needs of the increasing problem of Palestinians being expelled out of their homeland in historical Palestine. At the time of the Israeli invasion in April of 2002, 13,000 people, or approximately 13,000 people, lived in the refugee camp of Jenin. 55% of the population were children under the age of 16. The overwhelming majority of the population in Jenin were elders and children.
You mentioned that these are people uprooted from the Israeli war of 1948-49. I understood that the land they would have lived on previously was about 300 times what they were cramped into when they ultimately found refuge in Jenin.
True, Mordecai. 531 Palestinian villages and small towns were completely destroyed during the expelling of the Palestinians and the occupation of Palestine in 1948. The people of Jenin, in particular, had a very bitter story dealing with that particular issue, because they were displaced on a 1 square kilometer, which is the Jenin refugee camp today, and most of these people were in fact able to see the land in Palestine in which they were expelled from at a certain point. It made it much more difficult because they were indeed close in distance to that land, but in reality 50 years of dispossession have separated them.
Now, in your book, you refer to mirror opposite images that Jenin refugee camp had for Palestinians on one side and for the Israeli state and military on the other. What were these opposite images?
In fact, it was the same opposite images that we see displaying itself during this Palestinian uprising, the Intifada, before and most likely for years to come. Palestinians see themselves as defenders of their land, of their integrity, of their freedom. People who are seeking self-determination, people who are trying to live their life, the people who do not hate life, they love their lives, they love to live, but they have to defend it in order for them to survive. They see themselves as freedom fighters. The Israelis, on the other hand, refer to Jenin as the house of bees, a nest of terrorists, where Palestinian terrorism conveys itself in best ways. That's why they refer to every Palestinian fighter in Jenin as a terrorist. Many Western media outlets refer to them as militants, although, according to my research, many of the people who actually fought in Jenin, and there were not really many, there were 53 fighters who fought that entire battle of Jenin to defend the people, but most of the 53 who fought were actually security officers, they were police officers, they were... It was part of their job to defend the people of Jenin. In addition to the fact that there is some sort of confusion regarding the status of those fighters versus the civilian population, as if they were two separate entities. Kofi Annan, in his very lame report indeed about the situation in Jenin and the Battle of Jenin, he created that separation that the Palestinian militants and the Israeli army have put the civilian population in Jenin in harm's way, forgetting the fact that some of those who actually fought for Jenin were civilians who had to join the resistance, because if they did not, they would just sit down and watch the horror conveyed in Jenin, and seeing how the people of Jenin are being slaughtered defenselessly and without any form of protection. So some of the civilians have in fact joined the resistance in the last moment because they felt that was the right thing to do.
From the testimonies of the interviews, and I'd like to get to that a little bit later, there's certainly a great empathy and sense of appreciation from the people who were non-combatants in the Jenin refugee camp and the armed resistance. There's an intimacy and a warmth there which is very genuine. The Israeli government and its supporters, after the siege and assault on Jenin and the people of Jenin refugee camp, did a great deal to try and hide the events of that assault and to discredit the testimony of the victims. Could you outline a little bit about their efforts to put the spin on that?
Well, first, let's remember that the first person to use the term massacre, or in an official position, to use the term massacre, describing the events that unfolded in Jenin, is in fact Shimon Peres, who at the time was the foreign minister of Israel. That was reported in the Israeli Jerusalem Post. Israel at the same time prevented any attempt to allow medical personnel or journalists or investigators, and at certain point they blocked the United Nations fact-finding mission that tried to enter Jenin and to draw a real picture of what took place there. During that time, of course, Palestinians, who are very well aware of the kind of crimes that the Israeli army perpetrates against the civilian populations, had no other chance but to follow the ranks and expect that what happened in Jenin was a wholesale slaughter. So a number of 500 sprung, and I think it came out of the fact that several generals in the Israeli army said that we have killed and wounded hundreds of Palestinians. Now let's remember, Mordecai, that Israel usually tries to undermine the suffering of Palestinians. For example, in the Sabra and Shatila massacre in West Beirut in September of 1982, over 2,000 Palestinians and Lebanese were slaughtered. Israeli official counts put the number at 800 until now, despite the Red Cross information that thousands of people were killed. So when the Israelis came and they said hundreds of people were killed in Jenin, Palestinians, who are not allowed to even bury their dead in Jenin, had no other option but to expect that hundreds of people have in fact died in Jenin. Now, later on, information was revealed that 60, the most recent count by our book was 63 people were in fact killed in Jenin, 55% of them were civilians. And some of the combatants have in fact been executed after they were arrested. And over 270 people were wounded in Jenin, in addition to, of course, hundreds of people who were arrested. Now, the fact that the number have not reached 500, Israel was able to turn the table and to try to demonstrate, mainly in the mainstream media in the United States, that Palestinians have in fact exaggerated. Palestinians have lied. What really happened in Jenin was a fair battle between Palestinian terrorists and Israeli security forces who were trying to quell to destroy their terrorist infrastructure in Jenin, and we lost 23 soldiers. They lost this number that would not at any point reach 500. Therefore, it is Palestinians who deserve the blame of this. And at certain point, Palestinians were on the defense position, trying to show that even if the number was only 53 or 63, they are still worthy enough of being called victims. The issue is still worthy enough of being investigated. War crimes have in fact been committed in Jenin, according to the 4th Geneva Convention, and to the Hague Convention, and to international law in general, and the issue should not be dropped. But because of the way that Israel managed to use the mainstream media to violate that Palestinian right, the same way they always do, and to vilify the Palestinian position and to show them as a bunch of liars and people who exaggerate, the issue, unfortunately, was dropped, and the end of it, supposedly, was Kofi Annan's decision to dismantle the fact-finding mission in Jenin, followed by his decision to go on with the report based on NGO reports, including Israeli lobbyists in Washington, D.C., who have contributed to that report, including the ADR and AIPAC, and he concluded that there was no massacre in Jenin, and that was supposed to be the end of the story.
What struck me in reading the testimonies of the people who were interviewed, and I must say the interviewing seems to have been a very difficult but unintrusive one, because what comes across are specific, concrete descriptions of what people as individuals saw, what they heard, what they felt, what they smelled as these events were going across. One of the things that comes across to me most powerfully is the lack of any moral boundary to the atrocities which the Israelis were inflicting. And for me, one of the symbols of that, I guess, lack of moral boundaries, is the fact of shooting and killing someone and leaving the body, often mutilating the body, but leaving it on the street, and family or friends or neighbors trying to retrieve the body to give some respect to it, to bury the person. The body was left where snipers would then shoot at people trying to recover an already dead person, and that seemed to me to typify, regardless of number, the character of the actions of the Israeli occupying army.
I think it's very important what you just mentioned, Mordecai, regarding the moral boundaries. The usually in times like this, we deal with clear provisions within international law, trying to prove one particular point versus the other. But what is neglected is that the level of hatred, the level of atrocity committed by Israel that it's very difficult to categorize under certain provisions, even within the 4th Geneva Convention and Article 147, etc. The fact that they would enter a mosque and they would defecate on the Quran, the fact that they would enter a kindergarten and they would draw pornographic images on pictures that little children have drew and are very proud of and hanging on the wall of their little kindergarten that is called the Hope Kindergarten in Jenin. Just these kind of many atrocities that are in fact even more appalling, which shows that the issue here is not Israeli soldiers entered Jenin with a goodwill and they were really trying very hard to avoid civilian population, but oops, things went out of control a little bit and few civilians got killed. This is not the story that really happened in Jenin. It was one of the most appalling and shocking human tragedies that I have myself ever researched. It totally reminded me of the situation in Indonesia in 1966, 1967, when Suharto's men went out there killing, over a million person. Just the kind of hatred, the kind of violation of every human norm really did take place in Jenin. There is a story of the woman who her husband was killed by the Israelis, by a sniper. He was trying to rescue some of his children belonging, and he was shot in the middle of his house. And he fell, and he bled, and he died. And the woman took her husband. She put him in the only standing room in the house, and she covered him. She called the ambulance, and she bled to them to come and rescue her husband or to bury him, because she realized he died at a certain point. And the Red Crescent did try to come, but they were shot at by the Israelis. Now, the children who are 2, 3, and 4, I believe, come and they start asking, where's daddy? Well, daddy is dead, and the woman is not able to convey the fact that daddy is dead because she is trying to get the father out of the house as soon as possible. It's very hard to explain to a 2-year-old and a 3-year-old and a 4-year-old what death is and how do people die and why your father is dead. Well, she did not anticipate the fact that that man would be laying down for 7 days. And his body would decompose at a certain point because it was very hot in Jenin. And his body decomposed, and the children are still jumping on daddy's back, trying to wake him up to play with them and to give them the bottle or to read them a story. So for a whole week, that woman tried to maintain a lie that her husband was in fact sleeping, not dead, and been crying for that whole time, begging Israeli soldiers every time they passed by her house to, for goodness sake, allow the ambulance to come and take my husband's decomposed body. And they wouldn't. They would laugh at her, and they wouldn't allow for that to happen. This is just one of so many stories that equal in the level, the horrifying level, the shocking level of atrocity.
Well, I want to compliment you on the book, and I'll let people know how they can obtain it. And thank you very much for joining us this morning, Ramzi.
Thank you for having me, Mordecai, and keep up the good work.
I've been speaking with Ramzi Barud about his recently published book, Searching Jenin, Eyewitness Accounts of the Israeli Invasion. It has an introduction by Noam Chomsky. Ramzi is founder and editor of the online magazine PalestineChronicle.com. If you'd like a copy of Searching Jenin, it's going to be on sale at a Vancouver showing of the film Jenin, which is Saturday, April 12th at Simon Fraser University Harbor Center in downtown Vancouver at 7:30. But you can also order a copy of Searching Jenin by email. You send a message to info@cunepress.com.
You've been listening to a program produced by Red Eye, an alternative media collective which broadcasts every Saturday morning from 9 until noon on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM, in Vancouver, Canada.